Okay, so today today's Teisha will be on case number 4 from the Book of Equanimity, Osshoyo Roku. And I'd like to read the case out to start off with. The World Honored One points to the ground. Our first introduction. Once a speck of dust arises, the whole great earth is embraced in it. On a single horse and with a single lance, you enlarge the territory and widen the boundaries. That is not impossible. Who is the person who can be master at any place and embody the principle in any karma? Case. When the World Honored One was walking with his assembly, he pointed to the ground with his hand and said, "This place is good for building a temple." Indra took a stalk of grass and stuck it in the ground and said, "The temple has been built." The World Honored One smiled. Verse. The boundless spring upon 100 plants. Taking up whatever comes to hand, he can use it familiarly. The golden body of 16 feet. In assemblies of virtues, taking casually the hands of others, he walks into the scarlet dusts. He is able to be master amid all the dusts. While the guest spontaneously appears from beyond this world, everywhere life is sufficient according to its portion. It does not matter whether you are inferior to someone else or not. So that's today's koan. Just a little bit on the Shoyo Roku, or the Book of Equanimity. It was compiled in the 12th century by Master Wanshi, and he compiled it, and he also wrote the verse. And after a few years later, Bansho, he added instructions, and from what I understand, he also rewrote the Book of Equanimity a little bit as well. So, first of all, it's a Soto, it's considered a Soto book, the Book of Equanimity. And the word equanimity is quite nice, you know, the Book of Equanimity. Equanimity is one of the features of an awakened person, according to the Buddhist sutras. And really, what does equanimity mean? You know, equanimity is being able to not only to handle every situation, but at every moment, not needing it to be otherwise. You know, just think of that. You know, every situation, at every moment, not needing it to be otherwise. That's really when we can say we've got equanimity. Another interesting thing here is that I read that Wanshi, the compiler of the Book of Equanimity, he says that the book arose from an empty field. It arose from an empty field. That was one of his descriptions of it. So that's just a little bit of the Book of Equanimity. So it starts off with the introduction. Once a speck of dust arises, once a speck of dust arises, the whole great earth is embraced in it. Once a speck of dust arises, the whole great earth is embraced in it. So the first question, of course, comes along and says, well, what does this mean? You know, once a speck of, what is this dust? Of course, the introduction points always to the koan, so always keep that in mind, same as the verse, they always point to the koan. But here, once a speck of dust arises, the whole earth is embraced of it. So we look at dust and we might say illusion, or we might say look at dust as the hindrances, or a piece of dust might just be, this is a piece of dust, or I don't know if I can find a piece of dust, you know, this here it is, here's a little bit of dust. So here's a little bit of dust. What, you know, once a speck of dust arises, the whole earth is embraced in it. The whole or the great earth is embraced in it. So one of the ways of looking at that is we need to be able to have an experience, first of all, to be able to see it in different dimensions. When we haven't had an experience, when we're looking at a piece of dust as separate from something else, then that, of course, does not make sense. We could only really say that the whole earth embraces it as once we see that there is no separation between dust and anything else. In other words, it doesn't really matter what we call it, whether we call it dust or we call it a flower or we call it a stick or whatever we want to call it. If we see that there is no separation, then we can really say that the whole great earth or the whole universe embraces it. So I've made a little conceptual drawing right at the end here, and I just want to refer to that a little bit. And there's different ways of looking at this because it comes back to the teachings. You know, when I say it comes back to the teachings, in order to understand it, first there is what we would call the teachings or the raft, which in Buddhism is like you need a raft in order to cross from the shore of samsara to nirvana, or from our relative perception to the ultimate perception. You need something to hang on to that gets you there. If you don't have that, it's very difficult on our own to achieve this. So in Buddhism, it's called the raft. The raft, the Dharma, or the teachings to go from basically the conventional world, the dualistic world, into the non-dual world or the ultimate world. Dogen called it the circle of the way. And already that is a little bit, just the image is different, even though it's still a raft, it's still a teaching. In other words, all it is a teaching, all it is a pointer. It's not the thing itself. But with the circle, it already the image is there that it's not linear. When we say a raft is like there is samsara and then we go to nirvana. You know, there's like that we go to from one spot to the next spot. That's sort of almost the linear image that we can see. And then what happens after nirvana? What happens then? So that is not really, you know, according to the Buddhist teachings, after nirvana, you have to let go of the raft. You know, so that's sort of the traditional way of looking at it. You've got to get rid of the raft. You get rid of holding on to Buddhism and beliefs and symbols. You get rid of all of that. Okay, but when you have the circle, the circle of the way, then the image here that is somehow created is that we are always at one stage in the circle, because there's no it's infinite. And what's interesting too is that it is actually the symbol of Zen. You know, the circle or the Enzo is the symbol. The symbol of enlightenment is the circle. It's an infinite circle that goes around. So what happens is that we, at any moment, there are certain realizations that we have, if you like, in this circle of the way. And they are no good, they're no bad, there is no advancement. We can go backwards, we can go forwards. We're always somewhere on the circle, if you like. And to understand that somehow is to be able make sense, especially of this koan, I feel, especially about the introduction and the verse as well. So again, once a speck of dust arises, the whole great earth is embraced in it. Many koans point to this. Gute's finger, you know, speck of dust, once Gute's finger. Those of you that worked on the Gute's fingers, just lifting up a finger. The teachers stick. You know. So we've had many koans on this. One, it arises. So the idea is, what is it actually that we see? So that's the question. What is it that we see? What can we really see that this is the whole? That there is no separation between this and anything else? So that's the first thing that comes up. Can we really see that? And that in this first line, that is what is proposed. Once a speck of dust arises, the whole great earth is embraced in it. So coming back to the circle, the circle is complete at any given time. Whether you see it or not doesn't really matter. Whether you have the realization of that doesn't matter That is within the circle, always there. We may not necessarily see it, but it's there. But we need to validate it in order to see it, of course. On a single horse and with a single lance, on a single horse and with a single lance. So the single horse here refers to Mu, our object of concentration. You know, on this, sorry, the single horse with a single lance. The lance refers to Mu. The single horse is this oneness. Okay. So we have this practice of Mu-ing. We Mu. And whatever comes up during our practice, we just slash it away with this lance. Bang! Get rid of it. Get rid of it. We just continue, just move on a single horse. This is sort of an image of our practice on a single horse. Single horse. There is only oneness. You know, we might see this oneness in different forms, and we might see it straight away. We might see, yes, everything is everything. When we see that everything is everything, we can say on a single horse. But before we see that, we can't really see it. You know, on a single horse, this there's a single horse, this oneness, you know. And with a single lance, you know, and with a single lance, and that lance is our practice of moving. You know, that's what this points to. We let go in our practice of the forms, the distractions that upsets us. We realize that everything is valid because we've got this single hold. No matter what it is, we just get rid of it. We come back to Mu. We come back to Mu. You enlarge, it goes on, you enlarge the territory and widen the boundaries. So if we can do that, if we can hold on to Mu, and if we can hold on to our practice, we enlarge the territory and broaden the boundaries. So this is sort of a reference to what it is actually we are seeing. What is it actually that is presenting itself to us in a different way, through different perceptions? And if you look at this circle again, I'd just like to go over that a little bit. So in the beginning on this circle, we might say we're born. We've got birth and death and duality. And so most of us, we live this world with this perception of I'm being born and I die, and this is that and this is this, and this is what I've got to do in order to make the most of it. And we're sort of trapped in this duality, and most of us are in this stage. That's where we're at. We are living within the conventions that are given to us. We've been taught conventions, whether that is our language, whether that is the conventions of metrics versus imperial, the conventions of our laws. We're living within the conventions, and we make the most of it. That's where we are. Then all of a sudden, practice comes along. Or so we have this whatever gets us here, whatever brings us here. All of a sudden, we have this need to practice and go beyond all of that. And there is no rhyme or reason why that is the case. So we then practice, and as you know, certainly in our tradition, but other traditions have different methods. We use sila, meaning the virtues aspect of it, the concentration, and also the wisdom part of it, which is implied in our practice. So we have the precepts, we have our sitting, our regular sitting that we do, and then through that we get the wisdom. And all of a sudden, we might have kensho, we might have a realization that is beyond the conventions. Okay, so this is what this is referring to. You enlarge the territory and widen the boundaries. That is not impossible. So when that happens, all of a sudden, it's enlarged. Our view is enlarged because we go beyond the conventional part of it. And just continuing on that, then all of a sudden we might realize, we might see that everything is empty within this circle. We might see that everything is empty. we then don't know really what to do with this emptiness. Is it, we might get stuck in the duality of this is empty, this is not empty, this is the relative, this is absolute. So there's again a stage that we might be sort of oscillating between. And by the way, that stage is quite interesting because in many ways that's one of the reasons we keep on practicing. The reason we keep on practicing is because we need to continuously, in many ways, use, coming back to the raft, use the symbols, whether that is a symbol of the Buddha or a symbol of just having a zendo or a symbol of having our practice at home or whatever symbols we use, the precepts, we use the symbols to somehow get us back to keep on enlarging our perspective and not to fall back into the conventional aspect of life that can so easily happen even after Kensho. So we keep on practicing, we keep on going. And all of this happens within the circle. In other words, whether we do it or not is immaterial. This is just a perception of it, the way we look at it. We then build a bridge, back to the conventions from this experience. And we use koans as that. Again, we use the zendo as that. We build a bridge somehow to back to the marketplace as well, to our life, somehow integrated. Eventually, there comes a point where that bridge is no, well, when I say it's no longer necessary, it is necessary, I feel, but all of a sudden it becomes easier. We can see things within the concept of conventions. We can see that conventions are conventions in one way and and they don't actually exist. So in order to be able to say that the dust is the whole, if in order to say that the dust is the whole universe, we need to not only see that, but at the same time we can say, no, dust is dust. Dust is just dust, from a conventional reality. But at the same time, we know that it's the whole thing. All of a sudden, the duality is no longer dual. There's no such thing as duality. It's just a means of looking at it. That is when we really start penetrating it in the day-to-day world, when we no longer need to differentiate between duality and non-duality, or between the ultimate and the relative. It just appears. We just see it, and whatever circumstances we are in, we engage with that. And that affects our conduct in the that affects our conduct in the marketplace. All of a sudden, no birth, no death. All of a sudden, no karma. Karma. We can see karma. It's a conventional designation. We all of a sudden really karma doesn't even come into it. There's no such thing as karma once we see that. But from a conventional way, of course, there's cause and effect. If I go outside and it's raining, I get wet. But from this perspective, all of a sudden, there's no contradiction anymore. We just see it. And so the circle of the way is, At any given moment, all of this is happening at once. All of it is happening at once. There is no sequence of this. We might just see it or we might not see it. But all of these things are happening at once. One person sees it, some other person doesn't see it. It's all happening at once, and everything is everything at once. That is the way I feel Dogen is presenting the circle of the way. So keeping going, just to keep going on this. Where are we? You enlarge the territory and widen the boundaries. So that is what is happening. But of course, in order to enlarge the territory, we need to have various validations of that, and that is why we keep on practicing. That is what what our practice is all about, to be able at any given time, we can fall back. 1 minute we see it, the next minute we don't see it. To enlarge the territory, we keep practicing. And it's saying it's not impossible. It's not impossible. Then it asks, who is the person who can be master at any place and embody the principle in any karma? So, of course, here this refers back to the Buddha. But I'd like to also make that, look at that as a challenge for myself or anyone really. Who is the person who can be master at any place? Any place. Doesn't matter whether you sit here in a zendo, be in your family, in your work situation, prisoners in prisons. It doesn't really matter where we are at any place. And because it says at any place and embody the principle in any karma, in any karma. So this is also interesting. Our past actions have got nothing to do with it. If you see that, it's in any karma, whatever causes and conditions, because you're looking at that from a relative perspective, they don't come into it. At any moment, right now, that's what matters. If you see right now, karma is extinguished. Where is there karma? It's only right now. Karma is past. You know, karma is a projection of the future. You know, right now, karma is extinguished. At any place. This is something I'd always try and bring home at when I teach in prisons. I bring this up actually in the course. I said, "What is karma?" You know, it's usually not an easy discussion to have with prisoners because they're looking at karma or cause and effect, from this conventional reality. But in a way, if they can get somehow a hold on it right now. That how you show up right now is all that matters. You know, how we show up right now, that is all that matters. You know, the past is the past. And of course, conventionally, we can say that all that conditioning, somehow the effects of that, we can't help but embody. But again, that's the conventional way of looking at it. When you look at, depending on where you are at the wheel, at the circle, it's all gone in the instant that we're realizing right now. Right now. It's just right now. Whatever it is that is occurring right now, this is the only thing that exists. The rest is a mental story. And that mental story traps us. And that mental story, of course, is our monkey mind. And that mental story doesn't let go. And that mental story is continuously interfering. And interfering with us being able to see right now. That's what it is doing. So that is what is meant with this. Who is the person who can be master, who can really see right now all the time? Even though we're there all the time, how can you not be in the now? But who can see that? Who is the person who can be master at any place and embody the principle in any karma? It's a very powerful way of looking at it, And then it goes to the koan. So, of course, it goes to the koan. And the koan is quite short and beautiful koan. I like it very much. And, of course, depending on where what we can see, depending on where we are at and what, on the wheel or on the circle. By the way, just one more thing on the circle. We can understand all these different aspects of the circle intellectually, but, of course, and that is one way, of course, intellectually we can get it. But the challenge is to really, can I really say this? That's the challenge, can I really say this? So I'll just read out the koan, the case again. When the world honored one was walking with his assembly, he pointed to the ground with his hand and said, "This place is good for building a temple." Indra took a stalk of grass, and he stuck it to the ground. Bang, he stuck it to the ground. And he said, "The temple has been built." The world honored one smiled. So how can a stalk of grass be the temple? That is the essence of this koan. How can a stalk of grass be a temple? This is, now that is the question. Okay, and that's a question that comes up in the Dokusan room. How can a stalk of grass be the temple? Conceptually, we might have all sorts of we might have all sorts of concepts about this that we can present, but that is not what is important. We really need to see that. You know, how can a stalk of grass be a temple? That is the essence of this koan. And the degree to which we see that, the degree to which we can really say that, to say it, to just repeat it, because it says that here, that's just belief. It's got nothing to do with belief. I mean, that some people might do that, but that is the question. How can a stalk of grass be a temple? How can a stalk of grass be the whole thing? Like, what is a temple? If a stalk of grass is a temple, then the temple is a stalk of grass. Yeah. How can a stick be the whole thing? How can a piece of dust encompass the whole thing? How can I be the whole thing? That's the question. That is what we need to realize. This allness that we get when we have a Kensho experience. That's when we can say it, and that's what happened. And what is nice about this is it doesn't really matter what situation, this is where equanimity comes in. It doesn't really matter what situation you're in. If you see that is the whole thing, then you completely, you're no longer trapped by circumstances needing to be otherwise. You know, that is the whole message. If we get that is liberation. If we really see that is liberation. It doesn't matter what we encounter. You know, if it's the whole thing, it doesn't really matter whether I'm dead or not. It's a body if I'm dead. It's just who's dead? What is dead? What is death? It's just a body laying there. It's nothing but dust, nothing but a stalk of grass eventually. Doesn't really matter what if the degree to which we see that is the degree which we're totally at peace, totally free. And again, it comes back to equanimity, you know. And so for those of us on that on the journey, which we of course all are, that is the essence of what we are validating over and over and over again. And of course, sometimes, you know, I see it quite often in the Dokusan room, sometimes it's very clear and sometimes it's not. So we keep on sitting, we keep on practicing until it becomes a default situation. And for it to become a default situation, I mean, that is like, that's where the Buddha was at. You know, that's a way up there. You know, who can really say that that's a default situation? That means no more buttons are being pushed. You know, or realizing that if a button is being pushed and we are triggered in some way, that is nothing other than the whole thing at any given moment. You know, that's being able to enlarge, coming back to the circle of the way, enlarge the view so at any given moment you see what it is. You might sit there and have an argument with someone, you see where they're at, but you might be somewhere completely different on the circle. You don't need to engage at all, you know. So this is a little bit about this. So how can the temple be a stalk of grass? That's the question. Now, okay, I just want to talk a little bit more about it. So when the world honored one, of course, is the Buddha. I won't talk too much about his biography. You've heard a lot about that already. He pointed to the ground with his hand and said, "This place is good for building a temple." Now, that doesn't mean that simply because Indra said, oh, the temple is already built, that we don't need to build temples, okay? A temple is nothing other than a blade of grass. Whether we have a temple or not is completely irrelevant. You know, if we have a temple, it's just as good as having no temple. It's just the way it is. You know, everything is presenting itself just simply the way it is. Doesn't mean to say we don't need to build temples or bridges or whatever we build. It doesn't mean that at all. Indra was a deity coming back to the Veda religion. So he was already seen as a deity, and the Buddha did not deny that Indra or these deities existed. He was called the god or the master, what was he called? The king of gods, the king of gods. But he is in another realm as far as Buddhist mythology is concerned or Buddhist cosmology is concerned. We can look at Indra, like he's famous for Indra's net. You know, you may have heard of Indra's net, and Indra's net is this interconnectedness of everything. And it comes back to what is a blade of grass, what is a temple, that interconnectedness, one is all is one. Or the manyness in the multitude, if you like, in the oneness. So that sort of interests Net a little bit. And again, coming back to the circle, it's quite interesting. When you look at the circle, you can also make the analogy of the circle being interests Net. Everything is happening at once in the net. You know, so that's another way of looking at it. Okay, the verse. The boundless spring upon 100 plants. Okay, so the boundless spring upon one of them. This comes back to this one is many. Yeah, one spring and upon 100,000, millions of plants, everything is affected. So this oneness affects the whole thing. But also, you know, it is the whole thing. That's really the key message, that the boundless spring upon 100 plants, really the boundless spring is nothing other than the 100 plants. Another way of looking at it is emptiness as form. You know, the boundless spring, in Buddhism, you would say the emptiness of it. You know, it's all emptiness. There's nothing really that you can. This emptiness of it, you know, is nothing other than the form. You know, it's nothing other than the many. You know, if you were a Christian, you would say God is nothing other than the many. Yeah? So there's different labels that we can use. And here he uses the word the boundless spring. It's very nice. It's just very poetic. The boundless spring upon 100 plants. Taking up whatever comes to hand, he can use it familiarly. And this is, depending on what awareness we have within the circle, it doesn't matter what comes up, we can use it freely. Because we are not stuck in a convention. We are not stuck in right or wrong. We are not stuck in blue and yellow. We are not stuck in many and one. We are not stuck at all. We can see through it all. And yet, we can say it's one. We can say it's wrong. We can say it's whatever we want to say. We can say that knowing and being informed with this boundless, there's nothing that is wrong. How can anything be wrong? Everything is best. You know. So we can say it like that. Taking up whatever comes to hand, he can use it familiarly. And just a few things on that. Like this comes, you know, if you want to test this yourself, you know, one way to test that is to look at relationships. You know, relationships is probably one of the hardest things to test ourselves on, because in relationships we see our buttons being pressed, and we see whether we are whether we really experience equanimity or not. You know, that slightest bit of criticism can just change us like that. You know, our self-image may be challenged, and that can send us into a spiral. You know, our self-image can all of a sudden be dented or what. So this is where the rubber hits the road, is in these sorts of situations. Taking up whatever comes to hand, he can use it familiarly. If you can really walk away or not needing to be right or whatever, that is being able to be at any stage in the circle like that. Another way of looking at it, using duality very freely. Like I remember when my teacher used to pull me up on that. He said, oh no, that's dualistic, that's dualistic, dualistic. You know, he used to say, oh no, no, you're being dualistic. And all of a sudden, I realized There is no such thing. But I had to communicate to my teacher in a dualistic way. I said, stop. That's what I'm doing. There's no such thing. And then he accepted that. There's no such thing as dualism. It's you have got the dualism in your voice, in your thinking, not me. There's no such thing as dualism. So, you know, you can say, oh, it's dual. But you've got to really see there's no such thing. You know. And of course, we call that you're not being logical or you're contradicting yourself. There is no such thing as a contradiction. You know. Of course, if I go out in the shop and say, oh no, that's not butter, that's milk, because I know that everything is milk, they're gonna look at me and say, what the hell is the matter with him? You know, of course we need to discern it, and we cannot talk like that in front of everybody. It needs to be done according to the circumstances. But from an equanimity point of view, that is what gives us peace. You know, when we can really say that, when we can really see that, you know. So we can discriminate freely. You know, even though the teachers say, don't discriminate, don't think, don't do this, don't do that. There's all these teachings about it. These are just pointers on the way, on the circle. We need to say, don't do this, in order maybe to get to the Kensho experience. But once it's had, oh man, it's like that all falls away. Thinking is nothing other than silence. And there are quite a few koans on that. How do you speak without a tongue? Blah, 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 blah. How do you speak? There are so many koans on this. And this is important, you know, to free ourselves from all these conventions. But we get stuck on them. But at the same time, we need them. So this is what this is pointing to. Taking up whatever comes to hand, he can use it familiarly. It's the same as choice, you know. We can say there's no such thing as choice. Everything happens because it happens. Yet, I choose to pick that glass up or not. I can say I choose to pick it up. I can say no, it picks up. I can say it so many different ways. Doesn't matter which way I say it, you know. But if we get stuck on one way of looking at it, we are not looking at the whole circle. Different ways on the circle. It goes on, the golden body of 16 feet, an assemblage of virtue. So the golden body here refers to the Buddha. And an assemblage of virtue, the way to look at an assemblage of virtue is not necessarily that we now all of a sudden fall into the precepts. Okay, these are the virtue. Of course, we practice the precepts in a conventional way, but it's actually also to go beyond that, to see that everything is complete all the time. That is an assemblage of virtues. Everything is complete. Everything. Pat and I had a discussion about this today in the car. Everything is complete. At any given time, that can never ever be otherwise. That's why. Can never be otherwise. Then my mind comes in and then starts arguing, oh no, that's not complete, or that should be this way, or that should be this way. And this is negative, this is positive, and this is the precept, and this is not following the precept, and we go on and on and on and on. You know. And of course, depending on where we are at on the circle of the way, you know, that's what we do. The golden body of 16 feet, an assemblage of virtue. So this is like referring to the Buddha, and of course he's our model, if you like. Taking casually the hands of others, he or she walks into the scarlet dusts. Taking casually the hands of others, he or she walks into the scarlet dusts. This is this relational, relationships are a big part. So this is about relational existence, you know. relational existence is, what happens is we, of course, look at it from a me perspective. And when I look at it from a me perspective, then there's a relationship. Whether that relationship is with this cushion or with this, you know, even with this folder, I say, that's an old folder, that looks a bit shabby. That's a relation. There's a relationship, you know. There's always a relationship, you know. Taking casually the hands of others, he or she walks into the scarlet dusts, you know. So this is like, in a way, we can't help, because we're wired that way, to look at it from a me perspective. In a way, we can't help but continuously, you know, looking at relationships, whatever that relationship might be. But of course, with open eyes, with this awareness, this is, you know, another way of looking at that is we, you know, our activity in the marketplace is that is because of that is really the relationship that we have. Also, I just wrote down here, the Buddha takes the hands of others, knowing there is no other. You know, that's the other way of looking at it. You know, we have all these relationships, knowing is nothing other than myself. You know, I remember when I realized, when I was doing a prostration in front of the Buddha, and I was reading somewhere that someone complained to the Yamada Koen Roshi, so not the existing abbot, but the previous one, that they were Christians and they didn't really like to do this, you know, do a prostration in front of the Buddha, and that was challenging. And Yamada Koen Roshi said, but don't you see that you are prostrating in front of yourself? And I remember reading that early on, and I thought, oh, wow, yes, you know, that's what it is. There's no Buddha, you know. It's a mirror. The whole thing is a mirror. I just see the form as separate, but it's nothing other than a mirror. I'm prostrating myself, you know. It's just a prostration, you know. And if I can see that as a, you know, if I can see everything as a mirror, it doesn't matter whether it's my wife, whether it's a car, whether it's a sky, you know, that's like the dust. It's all a mirror. That's another way of looking at that. Taking casualty hands of others, he walks into the scarlet dust. He is able to master amid all the dust. He is able to master. You know. And, you know, you can, again, you can only, it's able to master means when you see everything as yourself. There is no other. There is no other. One existence. Then there is no mastering. What is there to master? All of a sudden, that controlling or mastering, the way we're looking at master, is like you need something that someone masters. But when you see that there is no other, there's nothing to master. And in that point, everything is mastered. Because there's nothing. It's all the way it is. At any given moment, there's nothing to master. Nothing, again, coming back to equanimity. Does not need to be any other way than the way it is. Doesn't need to be, you know, that sort of from that perspective. See the dust for what it is, a mirror, you know, or the whole thing. Of course, we can look at what is our dust. What are we stuck on? You know, these are interesting things to work on. You know, what are we stuck on? And look at it, you know, depending on where you are on the wheel, you know, we can look at these sorts of things like that. While the guest spontaneously appears from beyond this world, okay, so here the guest is, might seem like separation, but here the guest refers to the Dharma or the wisdom that we get or the insights that we get. All of a sudden, like, oh, there's no Buddha, there's just me. Like, what am I prostrating? That's a guess, that just appears. It just, that insight just appears, you know. That is what is referred to here. The guest appears. So while the guest spontaneously appears from beyond this world, okay, that's the way he wrote it down. Where does that come from, this insight? The Dharma spontaneously appears beyond the world. And, you know, again, something we discussed in the car, Pat and I discussed today in the car, it is like that. It just, we don't need to do anything. We sit, we do our practice, and it appears. And the reason it appears is, it appears because all of a sudden, we are allowing ourselves by shedding our monkey mind and our beliefs, and by letting go, it cannot, we all of a sudden, it's like wiping your glasses. All of a sudden we see it. It's just there. It just appears. Okay, here they call it guests, and it can get a little bit confusing with, you know, but it doesn't matter. That's what it's about. It's about all of a sudden it appears. We let go and it's there. While the guest spontaneously appears from beyond the world, everywhere life is sufficient according to its portion. Everywhere life is sufficient according to its portion. So the way to look at that is, if you look at right now, it is sufficient. I mean, this is again that realm beyond the conventions. But even intellectually, we can get a glimpse of that. Like when you really look at, if everyone looks at themselves right now, what is there that is lacking? Some of us may be working towards owning a house and renting, other one, or getting a car, or getting a better job, or retiring with enough money, or whatever situation we may be in. But right now, it is always sufficient. There is just no way it cannot be sufficient. Even in our deathbed, it's just, even when there's pain, it's always sufficient. You know, at any given moment, it's always sufficient. You know, so this is what that, everywhere life is sufficient according to its portion. You know, of course we can criticize that and, start apportioning it to, you know, oh, now these are countries that need to give more to the ones that are poorer. And relatively speaking, that doesn't make sense, you know. But from this position of seeing it right now, it is sufficient according to its portion. The last sentence, it does not matter whether you are inferior to someone else or not. Here, it doesn't matter whether you are inferior. Of course, most of us would already be way beyond that, in the sense that we know inferior is just a story based on conventions. It's just, that's a self-image that we've may have created that says I'm inferior to someone else, and here it points that it doesn't matter, because that's just a story. How can anyone be, if a piece of dust is the entire universe, well, so are we. How can there be anything that is inferior or superior? There's no such thing as inferior or superior. So thank you. Let us continue our practice today, and thank you for listening.